Hospitalboro, WRSLP, Pittsfield, WLLO, Hunterbury, WVALMP, FL, WDJY, Framingham.
You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by volunteers and the staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Diane, and I will be reading from the Eagle Tribune. So, out of North Andover, the North Andover Historical Society announces a new executive director. North Andover Historical Society announced Sheila Hoffman as the organization's next executive director, June 1st. After a national search, Hoffman was selected by the Historical Society Search Committee due to her extensive experience. From her first interview with the Board of Directors, we are still struck by Dr. Hoffman's intellect, personal presence, and her focus on, not herself, but on us, and on her understanding of our vision and mission, said Stan Lindbergh, Board President. Her wealth of experience in history, management, and the arts will expand our society's horizons well beyond being merely house museums. Hoffman is a North Andover resident with dual doctorate degrees from the University of Paris, Sorbonne, in art history and the University of Quebec at Montreal, and heritage, cultural, mediation, and museum studies. Prior to accepting this position, she worked in leadership positions at the Rockwell Museum of Western Art in New York and Saginaw Art Museum in Michigan. While the position being local was a draw for Hoffman, she was mainly intrigued by the Historical Society's approach to history. The things that really interest me in North Andover Historical Society was that they weren't taking a dusty old approach to history, Hoffman said. The Historical Society has actually taken a forward-thinking, almost very futuristic approach to history. As she begins her tenure as executive director, Hoffman plans to utilize the Historical Society's new theater, where she hopes the community will gather to learn. It is a fantastic space for education, for presenting, for films, for people to come together as a community. I'd really love to maximize that space and help the community grow and learn and come together a lot more about various topics, she said. Hoffman also hopes to use local history as a stepping stone to global historic insights. I always say that all history is local history, so we've got some really fascinating things to explore. And we can use the local as a touchstone and expand to more global ideas if we want to, Hoffman said. As she looks forward to the future, Hoffman hopes the North Andover Historical Society will serve as a leader in energy use to other organizations locally. I love the idea of North Andover Historical Society leading cultural organizations in the area in terms of the net zero, geotherm, solar, or all of these alternative energies because of all the cultural organizations serve the communities, and finding the way to do so will reduce the financial draw we may make on communities, as well as, I think, really important, she said. Hoffman will be formally welcomed by the Historical Society during their annual meeting on June 14th. Here with me, I am reading from a laptop today, so I have to move on a little bit more normally. Okay, so regionally, drag shows on the U.S. military bases canceled by the Pentagon after Republican criticism. Interesting headline. President Joe Biden's administration has stopped U.S. military bases from hosting drag shows after criticism from some Republicans. Story by Noman Merchant. And this is from the Associated Press. President Joe Biden's administration has stopped U.S. military bases from hosting drag shows after criticism from some Republicans amid a broader push in conservative-led states targeting LGBTQ and celebrations. Hosting drag shows is inconsistent with regulations regarding the use of Defense Department resources, said Pentagon spokesman Sabrina Singh in a statement Thursday. At least one show was canceled as a result. Organizers of events at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada canceled the drag show timed to Pride Month, which began Thursday, according to a Facebook post quoted by Fox News. In her statement, Singh did not directly address LGBTQ and rights, but said the Defense Department was proud to serve alongside any and every young American who takes the oath that puts their life on the line in the defense of our country. Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican from Florida, who sharply criticized top Pentagon leaders earlier this year and questioned them about drag shows, tweeted that the cancellation was a huge victory. Quotes. Drag shows should not be taking place on military installations with taxpayer dollars, period. Yeah. Drag shows feature entertainers who dress and act as a different gender. They are often part of pride events and can include colorfully clad drag queens reading books to children. Supporters say they celebrate people of different sexual orientation and promote acceptance. Opponents accuse organizers of drag shows of trying to, in quotes, sexualize children. Drag shows sometimes draw protesters, and a bevy of Republican-led legislators have passed bills in recent months to try to ban or restrict them. Dallas Air Force Base has previously hosted drag performers. About 180 people attended a similar show in 2021, according to Task and Purpose, a publication covering the military. The Pentagon's move to cancel the show this week led to a human rights campaign which advocates for LGBT communities and civil rights to directly criticize Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Before today, Secretary Austin has been unwavering in the support for the LGBT communities and Americans who proudly serve in uniform. The group said in a statement, however, instead of truly standing up for our community on the first day of Pride, we chose to side with the politics of fear and discrimination peddled by extreme members of Congress.
Okay, here we go. The long song for Friday the 2nd of June. The three top banner pieces are a Chelmsford for the playground fundraiser whose honors the spirit of her daughter. The second one is La Crosse. Cancer-free Eniacin is one of Bill Ricker's all-time best. Recipe is mushroom chili quick smoky veggie dinner and heavy thunderstorms with high to 87 and low to 54 today. All right, the big news, cybersecurity. City updates employees on cyber attack. Municipal systems hacked since April 24th by Melanie Gilbert. Both the city and the school side of the world municipal operations updated employees on the cyber attack that has disrupted operations since the 24th of April. Lowell Public Schools Chief of Operating Officer James Hall sent an email to employees, that means you have to have email connection, on May 26th, that's like a month later, announcing that a LifeLock contract will be providing credit monitoring and alert services for 2 years. Employees will most likely be covered for 2 years. More information to follow next week. Hall wrote, it is anticipated that family members will also be able to enroll at no cost, but we are awaiting further details from the corporation. We are anticipating a June 1st start date for this credit, which means yesterday. And the credit is monitoring and alert services. So this is a credit monitoring and alert service. The ransomware group Play claimed responsibility for the cyber attack. On May 11th, Play said it had released five gigabytes of data from that theft and posted it to the dark web. The dark web is part of the internet that isn't indexed by mainstream search engines and requires special browsers like Tor. Permissions, software, and system configurations to access. It is used to keep internet activity anonymous and is fertile ground for illegal or criminal enterprises like play. Documents given to the Sun appear to show that the allegedly stolen data includes personal and personnel data such as medical billing records and employee disciplinary cases. Superintendent of Schools Joel Boyd and City Manager Tom Golden allocated more than $1 million of combined funding from their respective budgets to purchase LifeLock protection for all current city and school employees impacted by the cyber breach. But that LifeLock is only going to cover for like 2 years, right? On Wednesday, Golden updated employees with the effort to restore operations and functionality to the system. There continues to be an active and ongoing investigation, Golden wrote. As the investigation unfolds, all indicators suggest that the cyber-related event was limited in scope and neither affected the school side of the network nor any other system or services with which the internet page 2. Oh my. Page 2. Okay. It doesn't affect the school side of the network nor any other systems or services with which the city interacts. Key vendors, financial financial institutions, partners, and stakeholders were notified of the event in order to mitigate fraudulent activity. Something's going on here. Too much dump to the air. The document described the deployment of desktop PCs at 20%, while telephone and MUNIS services are at 99% restored capability. MUNIS is an enterprise resource planning technology. That's a mouthful. That manages financial, human resources, asset management, and revenues for municipal governments. In contrast, the service systems which store, send, and receive data are at 50% operational standards. While the city's 9/11 service was not affected, other public safety systems were, with the Lowell Police Department's booking system among those crippled by the attack. So the booking was sent off elsewhere. The department effected a mutual aid contract with Draken, which assumed responsibility for the bookings of all Lowell arrests. On May 21st, the document said that Larimore services, whoever that is, will restore to the radio room and other police areas. Larimore is a public safety software system used by the Lowell Police Department. Oh. Golden's update included pending actions such as the reset of all telephone account and website account credentials. Additionally, everyone will get registered into additional multi-factor authentication services. Multi-factor authentication. Authentication. authentication purposes. It is still not known how the cyber criminals access Lowell's network. The Goldman's update notes that cybersecurity is an evolving threat requiring constant vigilance, and safe computing is everyone's responsibility. Well, maybe we're there for even if we don't even have it. All right, what else? Pride Month. Pride is on the march in the 3rd District and beyond. Lori Trahane hosts a roundtable on LGBTQ plus work supporting residents. Photograph shows U.S. Rep. Lori Trahane, who kicked off the Pride Month by hosting the roundtable with community leaders at UMass Lowell on the 1st of June, which is yesterday, with Senior Manager Tom Golden and UMass Lowell Chancellor Julie Chen. Article by Melanie Gilbert. The Commonwealth is home to almost 7 million residents, with nearly 500,000 Bay Staters identifying as LGBTQ+. June is Pride Month, which honors the 1969 Stonewall Uprising in New York City, when police violently raided the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar, igniting a riot that led to the gay liberation movement. U.S. Rep. Lori Trahane kicked off Pride Month with a roundtable at UMass Lowell Thursday morning, at which she heard from 15 communities, their leaders, who provided resources, services, and support for the LGBTQ+ community. She introduced herself to the group as an ally, saying that she was committed to standing shoulder to shoulder with you to create opportunities and safe spaces for people in her 3rd congressional district, in the state and in the nation. It is up to all of us to ensure that we are protecting the lives and livelihoods of LGBTQ+ citizens across the world, she said. What about everybody else? Before opening up the floor to hear from the participants who work in academic, government, healthcare, business, and nonprofit sectors across the state. Some attendees like Issa Walder Georgis, ooh, that's not easy, and Messiah Jones here from Lowell, both work at the Center for Hope and Healing, whose mission is to end sexual violence. Julia Pina is the Executive Director for Student Diversity, Equity, and Belonging Initiative at Fitchburg State University, whose work focuses on identifying biases and creating a welcoming space for students on the campus. Overall, all the members present spoke to elevating awareness and visibility of the community through their outreach and education program. All right, page eight. There we go. To feeling that Massachusetts was a leader in creating an equitable environment, even as they recognized financial, political, and societal challenges to the effort. Same-sex marriage was legally recognized in 2004. Maura Healy was the first woman elected governor in the Commonwealth and the first lesbian governor in the U.S. And roundtable speaker Julie Chen is the first LGBTQ chancellor of the UMass Lowell system. Chen said inclusion was one of the pillars of the UMass Lowell 4-point strategy. Inclusion. All right, inclusion and 4-point strategy. We are very conscious of making sure that everybody at this university feels like they belong, she said, so that you can be your best self here at this university. She cited a survey of undergraduates in 2022 in which more than 1,000 students identified as LGBTQ+. We want to provide whatever resources our students need so that they can be successful, Jen said. The City of Lowell was represented by City Manager Tom Golden, who said The city stands with all of you. We want to make sure that everyone who comes to Lowell feels welcome, to make people feel comfortable, safe, and to want to be part of our community, to build a better tomorrow. Members of the community said their work was threatened by white supremacy groups like the Proud Boys, anti-LGBTQ groups like Mass Resistance, and the Mass Family Institute, which are headquartered in Massachusetts. Anthony Bavenzi is the president of the No Woke Pride, a gay and lesbian organization based in Fitchburg that produces events and activities in North Worcester and beyond. Massachusetts is great on many fronts, but it is also the biggest safe haven for the white supremacist group, and they are constantly threatening our pride, he told Trahane. Right now, I'm receiving 10 death threats a week from white supremacist groups all over New England, including Massachusetts. The organization works closely with state and local police to monitor the threats and increase the security budget. There are five white supremacist groups based in Fitchburg. In Fitchburg, five. Belvenzi says the Proud Boys are based in Brookfield and Spencer. The gains made in trans rights are also threatened by racist-based groups operating in the Commonwealth, said Dallas Ducat. She is the executive director of the Director for Trans Health based out of Western Massachusetts, which provides gender-affirming care for people across the state in New England. Besides its medical services, the organization also trains students, doctors, physicians assistants, and nurse practitioners in gender-affirming health care. Like Bavinzi's NoLoco, a portion of trans health budget also goes to security to protect against anti-trans threats. Protect against anti-trans threats? As a clinic, we had to go silent until we received Homeland Security funding to be able to have safety, she said. We had to take our providers off the website. She said the threats represent an extreme radical element with the majority of people expressing a bipartisan support for LGBTQ issues. That was a position that Walter Gieser Ruiz pushed back on, saying, there's a notion that white supremacists are the fringe. They are built off of a foundation of white supremacy in this country that has existed long before Brown Boys. In closing, Trahane said the conversation was enlightening and she was committed to elevating the work and partnering with the groups represented at the table. We're going to continue leading the job of being vigilant along the way, she said. We are partners in this effort. All right. Yep.
Okay, so out of Boston, transit advocates push for regional rail system. The transit advocates are calling on state leaders to resurrect pre-pandemic plans to transition the MBTA's commuter rail into a regional rail system and lower fares to help attract more low-income riders. A new report from the advocacy group Transit Matters urges Governor Laura Healey and legislative leaders to modernize the commuter rail by making, quote, major investments in station upgrades, electrification of the rail system, and other improvements it urges will improve service and reliability while helping the state meet climate change goals. The transformation of our commuter rail network is still just as pressing as ever, said Jared Johnson, Trans Matters Executive Director, Transit if we want to spur the needed housing development, tackle congestion, and significantly cut transportation emissions through mode shift, making regional rail a reality is a must. While the MBTA is facing a widening budgetary shortfall and ridership is still not fully recovered to pre-pandemic levels, the group argues that the T should pursue a vision of high ridership, low-cost public transportation system that works for everyone rather than a managed fine. These improvements will only grow more expensive and complex with time, reports author notes. The Commonwealth cannot afford to wait for the reliability crisis to end to begin planning and making these investments. The report also calls for reduced fares on the commuter rail, arguing that the expensive, in quotes, and inequitable, in quotes, fare systems force low-income riders into long, less reliable bus trips while needlessly suppressing ridership in a world where many pre-COVID commuter rail riders work part or full-time from home. The Commonwealth can shape the future it needs to remain competitive, livable, and affordable, the report's author wrote. Regional rail is crucial to doing so. It's time to move forward. Piolis Commuter Services, the French company that has operated the commuter rail since 2014, and the MBTA have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on locomotive repairs, upgrading miles of rail tiles, switches and signals, and other work to improve service after the brutal winter of 2015 crippled much of the system. But transit advocates say the current system limits options for riders who reverse commute, and it doesn't provide enough frequent connections between gateway cities and Boston. That prevents the system, which served an average of 127,000 daily passengers across 138 stations prior to the pandemic, from growing ridership or generating more revenue. Electrifying the rail network would serve dual goals of reducing congestion and lowering emissions that scientists say are contributing to climate change, according to the author's report. Nearly half the commuter rail's locomotives will reach the end of their useful life by 2030. These diesel locomotives are expensive to maintain and produce black carbon emissions that contribute to greenhouse gas emissions and threaten public health. The shift to a regional rail system is supported by many lawmakers, including Senator Brandon Crighton, Democrat from Lynn, who urges that the MBTA outdated commuter rail system fails to meet the diverse needs of those who rely on public transportation. It's time to modernize our commuter rail and invest in regional rail that will create more affordable, sustainable, and reliable services, he said. By embracing this transformation, we can ensure a transportation network that connects communities, reduces traffic congestion, and promotes economic growth. State Representative Andy Vargas, Democratic from Haverhill, also backs the effort. He argues that the commuter rail fares should be reduced to make it more affordable for low-income riders. If we want to truly be a Massachusetts for all, few priorities can have more of an impact than an electrified, reliable, fast, and affordable regional rail, Vargas said. The status quo of $24 round trip from Haverhill to Boston will never attract ridership.
Okay, we're having a problem with animals. The MSPCA, overcrowded dog shelters are in crisis mode. I think after skimming this article, too many people are adopting animals and they can't deal with them, so then they bring them over to MSPCA and they have to be euthanized at some point. Lance Reynolds of the Boston Herald. More than 100 dogs are up for adoption through MSPCA Angel, an organization officials say that are seeking potential adopters who can immediately provide the pooches with forever homes. Adoption fees for all large breed adult dogs 1 year older are being waived, and this is between June 11th and the 18th. This is the beginning of an ambitious goal of placing 2,000 500 dogs into homes by the fall. A campaign spurred by what officials are describing as a crisis amid plummeting adoptions and overcrowded shelters. Well, there are a lot of people, if they're working, they can't take care of these animals. For the MSPCA's adoption campaign to be successful, 142 dogs already bunking down in the organization's adoption centers in Boston, Methuen, Salem, and Centerville on Cape Cod need to be placed in homes as soon as possible, according to an official's release Wednesday. Mike Kelly, MSPCA's Director of Adoption Centers and Programs, said the organization has taken in 10% more dogs so far this year compared to the first half of 2022 due to an increase in owner surrenders. The dogs currently at MSPCA are a mix of local surrenders and those brought here through transport, said Sarah Rose Brenner, Senior Public Relations Manager for MSPCA. Transport means they must be coming from different states. The reasons for surrenders vary, with some related to law enforcement cases and others due to changes in living circumstances, she told the Herald. We must find creative solutions to ensure these pets have a safe place to go. This crisis is even forcing many shelters that receive transported pets to pause those relocations because they are at or over capacity. As shelters become more and more crowded, euthanasia has been on the climb across the country. Nearly 130,000 dogs that have been at shelters were put down last year, a roughly 39% increase from the 93,697 in 2021, according to Shelter Animals Count, which tracked animal shelter data nationwide. Officials say they suspect the trend is continuing, as nearly twice as many dogs did not leave the shelters alive during the first 3 months of this year compared to the same period in 2021. SAC. What is SAC? SAC. SAC figures. Shelter Animal Count. All right. SAC figures released last week's show. Without action from the MSPCA and others, as many as 150,000 dogs or more could be at risk this year, Kelly said. MSPCA will be holding adoption events at all four adoption centers throughout the summer months. The summer months? All right. With the first taking place June 11th through the 18th. Okay. Today, 5-minute read. The Pride flag raising is being celebrated in the kickoff of Pride Month today on the 2nd of June at 10 a.m., which is already 30 minutes past, with a flag raising ceremony and a performance by the New England Pride Color Guard Ensemble in front of City Hall at 375 Merrimack Street. The public is also invited during the Color Guard and the party band join the Color Guard and the party band as they lead a parade from City Hall to Kerouac Park, 75 Bridge Street, for a noon to four. What? That's 4 hours. It's hot day. Noon to 4 p.m. festival. For information, you have a telephone number to call 978-674-1482 or email rdei@lowermass.gov. That's 978-674-1482 or email rdei@lowermass.gov. There will also be a hydrant flushing in Lowell, the protective road neighborhood from Beaver Brook to Riverside Street and between the Merrimack River to the Drakett Line, which doesn't identify to people a whole lot, will undergo spring hydrant flushing and gate turning services. Is that the dam, the gate turning service? For the city's water department from Monday, June 5 to Friday, June 9. Residents throughout the protectable area may experience a drop in water pressure and or water discoloration during this operation. Although the water is safe to use during this time, residents should refrain from doing laundry while water is discolored because it will stain the clothes. Following this gate replacement work, residents who are experiencing discoloration should run the cold water in the bathtub or sink until the water runs clear. For information, call 978-674-1675. The Lowell Health Fair. The Lowell Community Health Center is holding an insurance renewal fair on Saturday, June 10th from 9 to 1, 161 Jackson Street. Insurance navigators will be available to help walk-in clients with the application process and determine eligibility for affordable health insurance plans. For information, call 978-937-9700. Well, that's good. So there are a lot of people who are in need who don't have all this technology. The telephones are much better. Okay, jazz concert. Lowell, the seven musicians of Bill Willis, signifying natives, takes the stage of Middlesex Community College's Donahue Family Academic Arts Center Wednesday, June 14th at 6:08 p.m., 240 Central Street. All right. The band features Bill Lowe, tuba, bass trombone, Hafiz Modulaza, saxophone, Taylor Ho Bynum, cornet, Kevin Harris on the piano, Ken Fiorano, acoustic bass, Lisa Gray drums, Religi Macedo vocals. Tickets are $15. To purchase, go to bit.ly. 3 I 0 3 2 6 I. Parking is available at the Early Garage, 135 Middlesex Street. That's quite an intersection across by foot. For information, call 800-816-3434. The event is sponsored by Middlesex College, Eastern Bank, the Arts League of Lowell, Sitting Out Restaurant, Rest Lounge, which is on Central Street, and Jeff and Mary Hart. Oh. Strawberry Festival, Concord. Join the Vero Farm for the annual Strawberry Festival on Saturday, June 17th from 9 to 1 p.m. It's at 11 Wheeler Road. Visitors can enjoy live music, hayrides, and photo ops. Tickets are priced at $10 per person and include entry to the festival and strawberry shortcake with homemade whipped cream. Homemade, but it's at a commercial Vero Farm. Ages 5 and under are free. To purchase tickets, go to verofarm.com/events/calendar. Okay.
Okay, so in Salisbury, the Riverfest moving to Salisbury. The 21st Annual Riverfest Music Festival has been announced. With a new host for the first time in years, as the tunes travel across the Merrimack River from Newburyport into Salisbury. The festival, produced by radio station WXRD 92.5 The River, will assist from the Salisbury Beach Partnership. It is scheduled for August 26th at Salisbury Beach. The first act is set to take the stage at 12:15 p.m., with the final act wrapping up at 6 p.m. The opening band is Steve Rundle. He will be performing from 12:15 p.m. to 1 p.m. and from 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m. band will be performing another band. It's called Air Traffic Controller. And from 3 to 4, it'll be by the Ryan Montague Band, the River General Manager, Dan St. Savoir, said. As to who will be headlining Day of Music, St. Savoir became coy after saying the act would be announced next month, July 11th, to be exact. Newburyport Chief of Staff Andrew Levine explained why the city was bowing out this year as host. We are planning a significant amount of work on the riverfront, so it wouldn't be possible this year with the amount of construction that would be taking place down there. There would be construction equipment staged in parking lots and adjacent areas, and it would make having a concert at the size of Riverfest pretty difficult this year, Levine said. Despite the venue change, St. Savoir said that there has been a lot of excitement for people in town. The communities are very close, so I think over the course of the last 21 years, I'm sure there have been many listeners and residents from Southbury who have traveled a few miles down the road to go to Newbury. Hopefully that will occur in a vice versa manner, that our fans from the Newburyport area will head to Southbury Beach and enjoy a day of free music, St. Savoir said. He said that the event always creates a large turnout, with last year's concert drawing in around 3,000 people. We have had large events at different venues in Gloucester and in Newburyport over the course of the years. 2018 was probably one of the largest Newburyport gatherings when we had the Bare Naked Ladies event. I'd say we can hope to exceed 3,000 to 5,000 people on a Broadway boardwalk and along the beach, St. Savoir said. It's worth presented the concept of Riverfest to the Board of Selectmen on Monday, May 22nd, and received universal positive reactions. Just want to thank you for coming to Salisbury. We've made a good decision coming across the river, Selectman Chuck Davisinian said. St. Savoir spoke about working with the Salisbury Beach Partnership. They really stewarded just a phenomenal amount of new activity and improvements and betterments. And we are really excited to help create more awareness about what has been developed over the last 2 or 3 years. And I think we're going to be really excited to be there, and it should be very festive, St. Savoir said. Levine said they would be open to hosting them again in the future, and that he was happy they could find another location. We are glad that they found a good spot to go to as a temporary solution, and should they wish to return, we'll be happy to have them. It's a nice thing to have because it gets people excited about the city. But as far as area businesses go, we still feel good about being able to bring a lot of people to the city during the summer. And I don't think we should take much of a hit in business, Levine said. Okay, what else? April Art Walk is Saturday. So out of April, the April Art Walk takes place Saturday, June 3rd from 1 to 7 p.m. In and around the downtown area. The Art Walk highlights local businesses, forgotten alleyways, and underutilized spaces, the artists market, clean air painting, exhibitions, demonstrations, and musical performances. There is a schedule of events, family fun from 1 to 5 in Columbus Park, artist market with live music from 1 to 5 in the alleyways between 69 and 89 Washington Street, live music from 1 to 6 p.m. in Washington Square, local artists and artisans from 1 to 6 at the Wayne Rabbit, 53 Wingate Street, Mas Fuertes Unidos, Strong United Art, Art Show from 1 to 7 p.m. at 90 Washington Street, 2nd floor. Kevin Angelo Live Mural Installation from 1 to 7 p.m. by the Mayba Parking Garage, 43 Grant Street. Art Show by Martin Monic Hammer from 3 to 6 p.m. at Art Gallery, 43 Washington Street. Pub book, art demonstrations, and libations from 4 to 7 at the Peddler and Daughter. Peons, the Top, Barking Dog Jailhouse, Jeeves and Casablanca, Italian Heritage Walking Tour at 4:30 in front of the bus stop in Washington Square Maple. Art Walk Toast is at 6 p.m. at Casablanca. The Art Walk is supported by the Haverhill Cultural Council and Mass Culture Council.
Okay,
I think that's it on that. Do you have anything?
All right. Here we go. A Ray of Light. Keeping Julie's spirit alive. Chimpsford Mother collaborates with local businesses for playground fundraiser. Apparently, the Dillon family of Chimpsford takes a silly photo while visiting a friend's house in Connecticut. Okay. Mother Kristen Dillon is fundraising for an extension of Friendship Park called Journey's Place in honor of her 2-year-old who passed away unexpectedly December 2022. As part of the effort, Dillon is organizing Journey's Joy, a two-week collaboration with local businesses to further support the cause. From left Father Jack Dillon, Julie 1, Kristen and daughter Annalie, now 6. Article by Cameron Morsberger. Apparently, Julie Dillon came into the world at a really dark time, her mother Kristen Dillon said. Born April 2020, that's 3 years ago. The young girl shined like a ray of light to those around her. At just 2.5 years old, Julie's light went out, but her kind, joyful spirit lives on in her family's hearts and soon within the community she once called home. Since Julie's passing, Dillon has been fundraising for the creation of Julie's Place, an addition to the playground to Friendship Park at Roberts Field designed to accommodate children 2 to 5 years of age. The park was where Julie spent nearly every Monday, Dillon said. And they've already raised about $52,000 of the $145,000 goal. To assist the cause, Dillon is orchestrating Julie's Joy, a two-week partnership with local businesses that will donate a portion of their proceeds to the potential park. More than 20 Chelmsford businesses have joined the collaborative effort, which starts June 16th and runs to June 30th. That support means everything to Dillon. This is an unimaginably painful experience to go through child loss, and especially without any reason. Julie just didn't wake up one day. It wasn't that there was any trauma or tragedy that led to her death, she said. And so it's been just incredibly moving and meaningful to have the entire community rally around us and support us and hold us up during this time. Well, there's a whole list of people giving discounts. Pure Battery, ABC Dance, 110 CrossFit, and other exercise spots and dance studios are accepting optional donations to the fundraiser. Mom Squad will offer 15% off of gift card Mom Squad. Maggie's Other Farm is hosting a dinner night on June 19th, and Teal Hair and Makeup will discount online and in-store sales by 15%. Kristen Rehartek, owner, page 4. Okay. Women's Boutique. Drizzy Rose is running a reservation-only shopping party. A shopping party? June 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at 2 hours in the store. After which she'll donate 10% of cumulative sales from that day and the day prior. Hartek's daughter, Amelia, is 2 years and 9 months old and loves Friendship Park just as much as Julie did. cannot take it. It's the reason why your family has already donated to Judy's Park and why she's proud to work alongside other business owners to raise awareness and funds. I'm really hoping that with the community business wise working together to try to donate some of that money. Aerotech says, fingers crossed that this project gets completed and this beautiful little girl is remembered in such a positive way. All right, the park expansion aims to feature a seesaw, they don't have that, interactive structures, and sensory equipment, according to a description on the Friends of Robert Field website. Dylan said the fundraiser will conclude in January 2024. They hope to install the equipment at the beginning of that summer. I want to do something that honored her at a place that she loved and also give back to the community. Though she's been available to provide guidance and resources, Chipswood Visit Development Director Lisa Malone said the initiative is all individually run by Dylan and other Chipswood residents. The overwhelming support for the cause is indicative of the local business community, Maroney said, which raises to the occasion, especially for an important personal mission. For me, the businesses that I work with are all just really genuine businesses, Maroney said. They care about their community, they care about issues that we try to address, and I'm not too surprised that they're stepping up to get involved in this fundraiser that really strikes to the heart. Grays Chemsford is a charcuterie and cheeseboard business. We'll be hosting a candle painting class and a mini cheeseboard across two different classes, and 20% off those classes will go to Julie's Place. Owner Abby Thatcher said, the store will also donate 20% sales across the entire two-week period. A member of the Chemsford Mothers Club, along with Dylan, Thatcher heard about Julie's story and was compelled to take action. Having just opened her business in December, the lifelong Chemsford resident said Julie's journey was the perfect opportunity to both promote her new venture and allow kids to enjoy the playground. Candle painting and a mini cheeseburger. It's really nice because I grew up here, so it's been really cool to see all the fun things happening, Thatcher said. I've been here for 35 years, and I bought a house here. Ooh. Started my business here, got married here, and I love it so much that I don't think I'm going to leave. The strong showing from the business community and beyond for the nonprofit is admirable and a source of pride for Maroney. It goes well beyond just the point of commerce, Maroney said. This is a family in need, and they're all rallying for the cause. Okay?
All right, time to take a 10-minute break.
Yep.
We will be back in 10 minutes. Thank you.
Is of significant concern to its members, especially as hospitals continue to experience capacity constraints and as facilities in the southeast support additional patients during the Brockton Hospital recovery. In these early stages, we hope that Compass staff can be quickly redeployed to other local facilities and that health plans will consider easing burdensome authorization requirements for patients in need of timely care, said Patricia Noga, Vice President of Clinical Affairs for the association. Dottie?
Thanks, Bob. Near normal hurricane season forecast. NOAA predicts 12 to 17 named storms. 1 to 4 could become major hurricanes, by Rick Sobey. After last year's hurricane season peaked with the incredibly powerful, deadly, and destructive Hurricane Ian, what do meteorologists expect for this summer and fall? As the 2023 Atlantic hurricane season kicked off on Thursday and goes until November 30th, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration forecasters are predicting near-normal hurricane activity this year. NOAA forecasters with the Climate Prediction Center, a division of the National Weather Service, are projecting a range of 12 to 17 total named storms. In parentheses, that's winds of 39 miles per hour or higher. Of those 5 to 9, of those 5 to 9 could become hurricanes. Again, in parentheses, that's winds of 74 miles per hour or higher, including 1 to 4 major hurricane. Again, parentheses, categories 3, 4, or 5, with winds of 111 miles per hour or higher. The upcoming Atlantic hurricane season is expected to be less active.
Test, test, test. Sounds fine to me. Test, test. Test. Yeah, you can turn the headphones down. He can turn the headphones up, I think, if he needs to.
Is the idea that you don't always need a goal. Sometimes the point is no point. Embrace it and everything becomes fun. More highlights, you'll step out of your comfort zone and take risks. You'll jump at the chance to travel, and no idea is too crazy for you to make it happen. Incredible new experiences wait. Virgo and Scorpio adore you, and your lucky numbers are 4, 10, 2, 33, and 14. And this has been Bob.
And Dottie.
Thank you so much for listening, and we wish you a fabulous Friday.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. Starting sunny, turning cloudy with rain later on in the day. Temperatures close to 90. Overnight, cloudy. Rainy temperatures in the lower 50s. Saturday, more clouds, more rain. Temperatures in the upper 50s. The sun rose this morning at 5:09, setting at 8:15 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center. Join the Talking Information Center to celebrate 45 years of service here on the South Shore at the 1620 Winery in Plymouth on Thursday, June 8th. The Talking Information Center is a nonprofit organization on the South Shore, providing newspapers, magazines, and best-selling books read by volunteers to the print-impaired population of Massachusetts. The evening features great food, a live and silent auction, dancing, and music provided by the band Total Strangers.
Give me that loving. Give me some itty bitty loving.
For more information on the Talking Information Center 45th Anniversary Celebration, log on to ticnetwork.org or text TIC Bash to 76278. That's the Talking Information Center 45th Anniversary Celebration, Thursday, June 8th, at the 1620 Winery at Cordage Park in Plymouth. We hope to see you there.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WBALLP FL, WDJM Framingham.
Coming up next from the Talking Information Center is the reading of the Washington Post. Please stay tuned to hear selected articles from this newspaper.
Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center reading the Washington Post for Friday, June 2, 2023. From the front page, Senate passes debt ceiling bill, sending it to Biden to sign into law. By Rachel Siegel, Marianne Levine, John Wagner, and Leanne Caldwell. The Senate passed a bipartisan bill late Thursday to suspend the debt ceiling and curb federal spending, sending the legislation to President Biden to sign into law in time to avert an unprecedented U.S. government default. The deal cleared the House on Wednesday night and is now on track to take effect by Monday, when the government would no longer be able to pay all of its bills without borrowing more money. Senators scrambled to vote before the weekend, even as a handful of frustrated lawmakers pushed for votes on amendments that risked slowing the process. None of the amendments were adopted. But in an effort to alleviate concerns from defense hawks that the debt ceiling bill would restrict Pentagon spending too much, Senate Majority Leader Charles E. Schumer, Democrat of New York, and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, issued a joint statement saying, "The debt ceiling deal does nothing to limit the Senate's ability to appropriate emergency supplemental funds to ensure our military capabilities are sufficient to deter China, Russia, and our other adversaries." The Senate vote of 63-36 capped weeks of talks that moved in fits and starts and at times dissolved altogether. As the June 5 default deadline ticked closer, negotiators from the White House and the House GOP clashed over government spending, work requirements for federal programs, and a slew of other policy differences. The final 99-page bill lost some support from far-right lawmakers and some liberal Democrats, but its final passage marked an end to months of partisan squabbles over raising the debt ceiling and averted economic catastrophe. "Our work is far from finished, but this agreement is a critical step forward and a reminder of what's possible when we act in the best interests of our country," President Biden said in a statement after the vote. "I look forward to signing this bill into law as soon as possible and addressing the American people directly tomorrow." In the Senate, four Democrats and Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, voted no, while 44 Democrats and Angus King, independent of Maine, who caucuses with them, and Kristen Sinema, independent of Arizona, voted yes. On the GOP side, 17 Republicans voted yes and 31 voted no. The bill needed 60 votes to pass. "Democrats are feeling very good tonight," Schumer said after the vote. "We've saved the country from the scourge of default, even though there were some on the other side who wanted default, who wanted to lead us to default." In a statement after the vote, McConnell credited House Republicans' efforts for avoiding a default and curbing Washington Democrats' addiction to reckless spending that grows our nation's debt. The Senate was largely sidelined during the negotiations, a dynamic that senators made clear to reporters and in floor speeches on Thursday. But the chamber moved quickly to approve the legislation after an overwhelmingly bipartisan vote in the House on Wednesday night. Senate leaders set the threshold for any amendments high enough that none of them were adopted, allowing lawmakers disgruntled with the deal to air their concerns without derailing the bill. The Senate voted on a total of 11 amendments, 10 from Republicans and one from a Democrat, before approving the deal. Earlier in the day, some Republicans urged an increase in defense spending. Others, like Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, pushed for deeper spending cuts. Senator Susan Collins of Maine, the top Republican on the Appropriations Committee, called on Schumer to commit to bringing all 12 appropriations bills to the floor in response to a provision in the deal that would set up additional automatic spending cuts if they were not passed. In a statement, Schumer and McConnell pledged to seek and facilitate floor consideration of these bills. And Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, wanted to remove a provision that would fast-track a controversial pipeline to carry natural gas across part of his state. Even so, the Senate showed there was little appetite for changes that would require sending the legislation back to the House. Earlier on Thursday, Schumer said such a move would almost guarantee default. The Treasury Department has warned that the country would run out of money to meet all its payment obligations on June 5, Monday, without any legislation, and revisions to the bill probably would have meant it could not pass until later next week. By the time the vote on final passage came, Schumer had been exhorting his colleagues to vote faster and faster on each amendment, calling out
That's a little better.
Okay. All right, you're listening to the Law Association for the Blind's LAB Radio, LAB Assistance Center for Massachusetts, Audio Investigation Network. We're meeting with several sites. It will be news and information. LAB Radio, Psyching Mass, WUSL.com, for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast live news and teachers. I'm
Senate passes a bill overturning student loan cancellations. Republican measure overturning President Joe Biden's student loan cancellation plan passed the Senate on Thursday and now awaits an expected veto. The vote was 52-46 with support from Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia, John Tester of Montana, as well as Arizona Senator Kristen Sinema, an independent. The resolution was approved last week by the GOP-controlled House by 218-203 votes. Biden has pledged to keep in place his commitment to cancel up to $20,000 in federal student loans for 43 million people. That's a lot. The legislation adds to Republican criticisms of the plan, which was halted in November in response to lawsuits from conservative opponents. The president's student loan schemes, the president's student loan schemes do not forgive debt. They just shift the burden from those who chose to take out loans onto those who never went to college or already fulfilled their commitment to pay off their loans. The Louisiana Senate Bill passes. Lead sponsored the Senate push. That's kind of confusing. The legislation aims to revoke Biden's cancellation plan and curtail the Education Department's ability to cancel student loans in the future. It would rescind Biden's latest extension of a payment clause that began early in the pandemic. It would retroactively add several months of student loan interest that was waived by Biden's extension. It would also roll back months of progress borrowers made towards loan cancellation through the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. Those who recently had their debt canceled through the program would have their loan reinstated. The GOP challenge invoked the Congressional Review Act, which allows Congress to undo recently enacted executive branch regulations. Passing a resolution requires a simple majority of both chambers, but overriding a presidential veto requires two-thirds majority in the House and Senate, and Republicans aren't expected to have enough support to do that. If Republicans were to get this their way and pass this bill into law, people across the country would have relief they're counting on snatched away from them, said Senator Patty Miller, Democrat of Washington. Then, Iowa. Residents of the collapsed building have been allowed to stay despite reports. Article by Scott McFetridge, Hannah Bingahut, and Ryan J. Porter of the Associated Press. Des Moines, Iowa. A structural engineer's report issued last week indicated a wall of a century-old apartment building, which was built in 1923, was at imminent risk of crumbling. Okay, yet neither the owner nor the city officials warned residents of the dangers before the building partially collapsed, leaving three people missing and three dead. The revelation is the latest flashpoint after Sunday's partial collapse of the building in Davenport, where residents had lashed out against city leaders over what they see as an inept response. Do I have regrets about this tragedy and about people potentially losing their lives? Hell yes. Do I think about this every moment? Hell yes. Mayor Mike Massey said Thursday. I have regrets about a lot of things. Believe me, we're going to look at this. City officials said Thursday that they did not order an evacuation because they relied on the engineer's assurance that the building remained safe. But it seems to be imminent risk of crumbling. the state's search and rescue team, search dogs, and cameras were used earnestly to continue combing the building for missing people. Mayor Mike Masson said crews were also consulting with experts about how to safely bring down the structure, which remains extremely unstable, while being respectful of bodies that could be buried in the debris. The six-story building collapsed shortly before 5 p.m. Sunday. That means partly collapsed. Rescue crews pulled 7 people from the building in their initial response and escorted out 12 others who could walk on their own. Later, 2 more people were rescued, including a woman who was removed from the fourth floor after authorities said they were going to begin setting up demolition. Earlier this week, authorities said 5 people were missing, but Davenport Police Chief Jeff Blando said during a media briefing Thursday morning that 2 of them have since been accounted for and are safe. City officials on Thursday named those unaccounted for as Brandon Colby and Ryan Hitchcock and Daniel Klein. The city said all 3 have high probability of being home at the time of the collapse, and their apartments were located in the collapsed zone. Oops. Blado said transient people also often enter the building, but there are no indications anyone else was inside and missing. How can we get in there? The city announced that each displaced household would be eligible for $6,000 in addition to a $5,000 state grant for households up to 200% of the federal poverty level. Money also would be available for businesses in the building and those nearby. But how do the transit get rebuilt? Apparently it must be easily accessed. City Administrator Corey Spiegel from the building likely filled as Bedford, given its age and the city will develop a plan to ensure workers and people in the area are protected when the remaining structure is demolished. Mayor Masson said he and others spoke seriously with officials from Miami-Dade County, Florida, about how they responded to the collapse of an apartment tower. The collapse of an apartment tower? In 2021, they killed 98 people. Wow. The city on Wednesday night released documents, including structural engineering reports, that show city officials and the building's owners were warned that the parts of the building were unstable. A report dated May 21st, just 4 days before the collapse, suggested patches in the west side of the building's brick facade appear ready to fall imminently and could be a safety hazard to cars or passers-by. The report also detailed that window openings, some filled and some unfilled, were insecure. In one case, the openings were bulging outward and looked poised to fall. Inside the first floor, unsupported window openings help explain why the facade is currently about to topple outward. Despite the warning, city officials did not order what about 50 tenants leave the building. 50 tenants live in a six-story building. Rich Oswald, the city's director of development and neighborhood services, said officials relied on assurances from the structural engineer hired by the building owner. The engineer said the building wasn't in imminent danger, but earlier said it was, of collapsing on residents. Andrew Walls, the building's owner, released a statement dated Tuesday saying our thoughts and prayers are with our tenants and that his company Davenport Hotel LLC is working with agencies to help them. county records show Davenport Hotel LLC acquired a building in 2021 in a deal worth $4.2 million. Records show that several bricks had fallen from the building's facade in 2020 after a severe windstorm. Okay.
Okay, back to more local news. In New Hampshire man has received guilty in the death of a cop driven by engineer Malouf out of Fresno. A Utah man is set to plead guilty on June 15th in Rockingham Superior Court to two counts of reckless conduct for his role in Aubrey's overdose death in 2020 at a Londonderry truck stop. Authorities responded to a call that a 21-month-old girl was in cardiac arrest at the
cell phone ban appears with the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education's long-range plan. Could state educators be charting a course to ban cell phone use by students during school hours? That certainly seems the case. If recent pronouncements by the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education or any indication, it has strongly encouraged that prohibition has yet to be introduced. Okay, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, which has strongly encouraged that prohibition, has yet to introduce that directive. However, it's weighing financial incentives for schools willing to put a cell phone ban to the test. Commissioner Jeffrey Ryder recently announced that the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education would likely create a matching grant program of up to $1 million for districts that pilot a cell phone restriction policy. This is not a mandate at this time, but we're certainly interested in piloting more of this. To that end, Riley invited teachers, administrators, and students from schools that already have instituted restrictions or bans to speak before the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education at their monthly meeting on May 23rd. I don't know where that is, but it's right there. Some school representatives discussed their policy requiring students to give up their phones at the start of class. You got to collect them, you got to put them somewhere. Other school districts restrict phone use in the hallways as well. The LK-8 Innovative School in Boston initiated one of the more innovative ideas. The Elliott makes students lock up their phones in magnetically sealed pouches as they come in. That means you've got to have monitors doing this for kids coming in the morning and then leaving in the afternoon. Students can carry them in case, carry the encased phones, but the pouches can only be unlocked by a teacher in emergencies or when students leave at the end of the day. For us, it was this opportunity to build more opportunities for social interaction, both instructionally and academically, said Elliott Executive Director Tracy Walker Griffith. Educators said students' reliance on devices increased during COVID-19 lockdown, which necessitated the use of digital means for social interaction and learning, of which some people were denied. One LA school 8th grader encapsulated the main benefits of a cell phone free school day. Gwyneth Zeke said not being able to use her cell phone during school was a wake-up call and had helped her learn not to be glued to the screen after returning to in-person learning. She said since the phone ban was instituted, she started interacting with new people and could focus on figuring out who I was beyond that screen that had been our lives for a year and a half. Some in attendance opinion that outright ban would deprive students the ability to exercise self-control and to learn how to use cell phones responsibly. Others have more practical concerns, including if other devices like Apple Watches would also be banned. Students' socialization and education benefits derived by keeping cell phones offline during school hours seem obvious. They might even regain attention spans exceeding a 10-second Snapchat. Wow. We agree with the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education's incremental approach to reach that ultimate cell phone ban and are waiting to see if financial incentives attract a critical mass of school districts. All right. Let's see what else we have here. Go.
So one little lobster is very happy today. A rare blue lobster finds a new home at Maritime in Boston.
commentary by David Mills, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. The president America needs is an unfortunate check, and the Constitution rules him out. He is also sadly for the world dead. Václav Havel, playwright and leader of those who opposed the Czechoslovakian communist regime and went to prison for it several times, was elected the free nation's first president after the 1989 Velvet Revolution, in which the regime just gave up. He served his nation as president from 1989 to 2003 and died in 2011. A few days ago, after reading through lots of news about current American politics, I came upon Vaclav Havel's memoir, To the Castle and Back, in a thrift store. 50 pages in, I thought, why can't we have a president like this? One of the great men of this in the last century. Havel actually thought about the world and what was right to do and not. And not just what would get him what he wanted. And one of the right things to do, probably the most important thing to do, was to tell the truth all the time, and even when you wanted to hide it, which would be a great thing in American business. But Trump lies like the rest of us breathe. So Trump lies like the rest of us breathe. He differs from his peers in presidential politics in degrees, not in time. He lies more blatantly, more carelessly, more contemptuously, but politics provides many different ways to lie. A politician can lie directly, or he can twist the narrative in his own favor, dodging questions and controlling events so no one can challenge the message. Dodging questions and controlling events so no one can challenge the message. For one, turn every important question into an excuse to play to a culture-worn audience. For another, promising great things you know you can't achieve. For third, everyone does it. In his first major address as president of Czechoslovakia, Havel told the people, I assume you did not propose me to this office so that I too would lie to you. As far as I can find, he didn't. How great that would be, living with it, if politics of lies feels like living with a thick fog in which you can't breathe easily or see clearly. It's like living inside the bass drum of a Norwegian death metal band where you can't think for the noise. It's like being Ingrid Bergman's character in Gaslight. Havel has some advantage over our politicians in the life he'd chosen to live, because it taught him how important truth was, simply to be fully human. His belief in truth has sustained him in long years of standing against the regime. He and his comrades have been able to sustain their resistance as long and as patiently as they did because they believed the truth had to be told and would do good when it was told. Repeating this defiant truth made sense in itself, regardless of whether it was ever appreciated or victorious, all repressed for the 100th time, he said. He explained his writing an open letter to the head of the regime in 1975, which could have easily got him put away in the prison camp. I simply wrote it in the belief that it might have, let's say, a certain socio-hygienic significance. In general, I believe it always makes sense to tell the truth in all circumstances. He and his comrades also believed the truth would eventually triumph, though maybe long after they were gone. They believed it was a seed that once sown would one day take root and send forth a shoot. No one knew when, but it would happen someday. Even a totalitarian government couldn't forever suppress the truth if people kept insisting on saying it. Havel became president in a historical accident, one of the rare times a nation enjoys the right man at the right time. political system won't produce a man like him. We won't get someone of his intellectual involved there. And our political system will eat alive anyone who insists on telling the truth all the time. But couldn't we have someone a little like Vaclav Havel, someone who would try to tell the truth, someone who would be willing to lose rather than lie, someone we can trust? David Mills is the associate editorial page editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Okay,
let's wrap up on a good note.
Okay.
I have an article that says, "Be Proud of Who You Are" by Dave Rogers. Being proud of yourself sounds like a no-brainer, doesn't it? How many times have we all heard that you need to be happy with yourself to truly be happy, and that no magical relationship will be determined if you keep from yourself? Now imagine being told by a large chunk of society that who you are is wrong and antithetical to being a true person. My goodness, it sounds terrible. But it happens way too often, not only
with two current officials and one former official, with access to sensitive intelligence from the region. Some independent analysts said Iran's increasingly aggressive behavior suggests that Tehran has, or believes it has, Russia's tacit support for ratcheting up the pressure campaign. Moscow has come to depend on its Iranian ally as a principal supplier of drones and other weapons for its military assault against Ukraine. The new resistance campaign is likely to find fertile ground in Arab-majority areas that chafe at the presence of U.S. forces and rule by the Kurdish Autonomous Authority that controls large swaths of Syria's east and northeast, experts said. Local competition for power and a messy, angry environment create an ideal climate to stir up unrest and organize militant groups, according to Aaron Lund, a fellow at the think tank Century International. Russia has emerged as the 12-year-old, Russia has emerged from the 12-year-old Syrian war as the region's principal power broker, having rescued the Assad regime and now presides over a shaky and complicated stalemate. While Moscow shares Syria's goal of ultimately ejecting U.S. forces and wants to reconcile the Assad regime with Turkey and the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurdish armed group that runs the autonomous east, it does not share Turkey's ambition of eliminating Kurdish control by force, which could cause chaos and an Islamic State resurgence, Lund said. Although Russia's alliance with Tehran has strengthened since the start of the Ukraine conflict, Russian and Iranian leaders have conflicting ideas about the post-war administration of Syria, and Russia has tacitly allowed Israel to carry out airstrikes against perceived Iranian threats inside Syria. One leaked document states that Russia's transactional relationship with Iran has been a source of friction between the two governments, and that Iran has repeatedly complained about being excluded from Russian-led negotiations with Turkey over a proposed permanent settlement to the conflict. Also from the front page, Phoenix area can't meet groundwater demands over next century, by Joshua Partlow, Yvonne Wingett Sanchez, and Isaac Stanley Becker. There is not enough groundwater underneath the Phoenix metropolitan area to meet projected demands over the next century, a finding that could threaten.
Test, test, test. Can you hear me? Perfectly? Adjust the volume on that one. Yeah. Is that louder? Is it getting any louder? No? Test, test, test.
That plans for future housing developments that rely solely on groundwater in outlying areas that have not yet verified their long-term water supply could not move forward. And as the climate gets hotter and drier in the West, and major water sources such as the Colorado River diminish, dwindling supplies of groundwater, as outlined in the new report, could portend a vastly different future than the one residents in the Southwest have come to expect. The long-awaited report, announced by Governor Katie Hobbs, projects that about 4% of the demand for groundwater, or 4.9 million acre-feet of water, will not be met over the next 100 years without further action. Terry Goddard, a former Phoenix mayor, said the message of Thursday's study is, "You're living on borrowed water." "You need to be conscious of every drop," he said. "You can't build unless you know exactly where the water is coming from." To build a subdivision in much of Arizona, developers must show they have enough water to last 100 years. Phoenix and many of the cities around it, such as Scottsdale, Mesa, Gilbert, and Goodyear, already have been designated by the state as having such assured water supplies that meet this threshold. But many places in Phoenix's outer ring that have been growing at a breakneck pace do not have these designations, and this report has the potential to complicate future development in those areas. In those areas, such as Queen Creek, Buckeye, and others, there is still an ample pipeline of roughly 80,000 homes that have been approved for future development. But new projects based solely on groundwater in such areas would not be able to get approval to build. To solve this problem, the town of Queen Creek, east of Phoenix, has been racing to import water from elsewhere in the state in an attempt to secure future supplies and satisfy its rapid growth. The town spent $27 million to buy Colorado River water from a farm in far western Arizona, which it expects to start arriving this month. And it made another $30 million deal for groundwater rights from the Harquahala Valley. But that water is still a long way from being ready to deliver, said Paul Gardner, the town's water resource director. And prices for these distant supplies are only going up. Gardner said Queen Creek has about 10,000 lots that are ready to build and won't be impacted by any new assessments of the groundwater supply. But future projects and a portion of current planned developments that don't yet have their water certifications could face problems, he said. You're still looking out your backyard going, we're building a lot of homes, Gardner said, but if you're the guy that doesn't have it, yeah, that's a big impact on you. He said there are five landowners in Queen Creek with plans to build some 6,000 homes who are in this situation. One of them is Dan Reeb, a developer and sixth-generation Arizonan who owns hundreds of acres in Queen Creek that has yet to be developed. Reeb is optimistic about Phoenix's long-term ability to manage its water shortages, but he believes the cost will rise to secure these supplies, something that could add $15,000 to $25,000 to the price of a home on average. Arizona has gotten very good at stamping out four-bed, two-and-a-half-bath, three-car garage homes and a great job to go with it, Reeb said. But at a time of increasing water scarcity, he adds, it's not going to be as inexpensive and simple as it has been for the last 50 years of phenomenal growth. I think Phoenix Metro is going to add another million people here, believe it or not, Reeb added. Beyond that, it will start to become an issue. The Arizona Department of Water Resources has issued these types of findings before in other areas around Phoenix. In 2019, a study of Pinal County's water management area to the southeast of the city found it was short 8 million acre-feet of groundwater, or about 10% of what was needed to meet its demands over the next century. In January, Hobbs released another groundwater report that found a deficit over 100 years in an area west of Phoenix known as the Hassayampa Subbasin, which supplies the fast-growing Buckeye area. 1 acre-foot is about 326,000 gallons of water. That determination has already resulted in major disruptions to the building industry, as large projects in these western suburbs have been halted until they can prove water supplies, according to building industry officials. That concludes today's reading from the Washington Post. My name is Jean, and it's been a pleasure to read for you today.
You were just listening to a reading of the Washington Post, brought to you from the Talking Information Center. As always, we thank you for listening, and you are cordially invited to visit our website, ticnetwork.org, for this and other programs.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. Starting sunny, turning cloudy with rain later on in the day. Temperatures close to 90. Overnight, cloudy. Rainy temperatures in the lower 50s. Saturday, more clouds, more rain. Temperatures in the upper 50s. The sun rose this morning at 5:09, setting at 8:15 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
Newton's Carroll Center for the Blind, one of the largest vision rehabilitation agencies in the nation, will host its 11th annual Walk for Independence on Saturday, June 3rd, from 8 a.m. to noon. It's a family-friendly event, bringing together both sighted and visually impaired individuals to support the nonprofit organization's mission. Walkers can choose either a 1, 2, or 3 mile stroll around the Mount Ida campus of UMass Amherst, located at 100 Carlson Avenue in Newton. And then stay for complimentary food, music, accessible games, and fun giveaways. Guide dogs and family pets on leashes are welcome. Individuals and teams can register at www.carol.org/walk. That's www.carol.org.